Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 13, Even More Software Tools. This will be the last lecture where we talk about Photoshop, and today we'll talk about some of the more advanced things that we've alluded to over the course of the semester but haven't actually been able to touch on yet or actually show you in a practical way. So if you remember from last time, one of the big things that we talked about was masking, and so I used some masking techniques to look like I was driving straight into a pile of sand. And if you remember, all that was done here was that there were two separate layers. There was a background layer, which was just me driving around in a car, and then there was a foreground layer, which was of a photo of white sands in New Mexico. And after applying a mask that looks like this, we were able to tell the top layer to only shine through, so to speak, specific parts, or only specific parts of the layer actually applies to the final image. So that way, by masking out these black areas here, we are telling this layer to not show in the final image. And so by doing that, we are able to composite essentially two images on top of each other and make this sort of effect. And so I had only a limited number of images to work with for this one, but you can imagine that there's many other times where it would be useful to apply a masking technique like this. So maybe you actually want to tell your boss that you're on vacation in Hawaii when actually you're doing something else, and you can take a photo of yourself in front of your wall, and you can just find some random picture of Hawaii on Google Images, and you can mask yourself in front of that image. And masking is actually quite a bit more useful than just making composite images like this. We can actually create adjustment layers where we can apply specific changes to an image. So maybe we want to increase an image's saturation, or maybe we want to selectively desaturate a particular image, and we can do that by adding a specific mask layer. So let's say that we want to increase saturation, like I mentioned. There's a variety of ways to do this, and I'm just going quickly through it now since we've already done it once, but now we can selectively saturate or desaturate specific portions. So let's say right now I want to completely desaturate the image, but in the by using a mask, we can actually re-select or resaturate certain portions of the image. So here we can just, for example, paint the color back on the image. That's looks pretty dull because there's not a lot of color in that specific portion. Oh, here we go. There's some blue from the sky, some green and some orange from the trees above. Are there any questions on masking before we move on? Okay, so one of the things that we've been talking about more recently than masking is the idea of color or color profiles, and how important it is that your color profiles match what your hardware is. In other words, that your computer is able to accurately show you what colors are described by a particular image. And color remains to be very important throughout this. And besides doing this idea of actually desaturating an image, we can desaturate an image, or we can convert an image to black and white through a variety of ways, not just through this desaturation, which does it in sort of a very dumb way, whereas, as you can see, it appears to be just changing the luminosity or applying a black and white filter in terms of the luminosity. But what we can actually do is apply different color filters to each of these particular, or to a particular image, to get different looking black and white images. And what do I mean by that? Well, if we take a look, for example, at a very simplistic color filter, we can look at the channels, that the color channels that make up the photo as a whole. And so, as you know, there's a red component, a green component, and a blue component to every pixel in this image. And so if we were to look at just the reds, for example, we can take out the green and the blue, then you can see that we have a black and white image that looks like this. And all that we've done is just removed the green and the blue color channels, and we're telling that the red color channel, from those values 0 to 255, rather than meaning red, we're just going to call them black to white. And so we can do the same thing. Rather than red, we can enable green. Oops. And now you can see that it looks slightly different as well. And the idea behind this, so here's red again, and there's green. You can see that there's a change, particularly in the sky up top. The green color channel looks a lot smoother than the red color channel. And so you can actually have quite a large difference in black and white images if you work with an original color image. And so rather than just messing around with the channels, though, you can keep your color image. And if you go up here to Image and Adjustments, got to select the entire thing here. We want to work with this background layer, Image, Adjustments, and we want the Channel Mixer. Now we can tell using actual values, actual numbers, we can tell Photoshop which channels are the most important for us in creating a black and white image. And so you can see that we have an output channel here, and we can remove certain aspects of every channel. So we can remove the red, for example, we can remove the green, and we can have just a blue color channel. And so what we want to do is maybe, let's say, we can look at a black and white image that has what's called a blue filter applied to it. And this is mimicked physically by taking a photo and actually putting a blue transparency, or actually a blue filter, in front of your camera. And this is what it would look like. It's filtering out all of the other colors in it. And so you can actually click through the variety of presets that are available and actually see how it changes. And you can tell that it actually changes the look of the image a great deal. So if you're into black and white photography, don't just take a photo in black and white on your camera. Take it in color, and then in Photoshop, actually mess around with this color channels and modify these different channels so that you can actually get the look that you want. And in fact, you'll notice that by using different color filters on top of it, you get different contrasts within the image as a whole. And there is a relatively easy way of figuring out what color filter you want to apply. So if you take a look at just a color wheel, for example, which just puts all of the colors in a circle, you can find a color. So for example, let's say that we have applied here a blue filter. So you can find the color blue on this color wheel, which is about here. And if you look at the other side, which is yellows and greens and some orange, those are the colors that are going to end up representing the most, or in other words, being the most contrasty in the black and white image. So if you have an image, for example, that has a sky in it, and you really want to show the contrast between the clouds and the blue sky behind it, you would find the opposite of sort of this light blue, and you would realize that you need to apply a red color filter. So you might try with a red color filter on an image that's primarily sky and get the most contrast in that particular portion that you want. So it's very color dependent when you're creating a black and white image, and you should determine which filter you want to use, either by trial and error or by looking at a color wheel. And so color then is still a very important thing. But, and we have to change gears a little bit here, something that is even bigger of a problem, color isn't even a problem in digital photography except for one thing. Why is color a problem for us as digital photographers in terms of the cameras themselves, or maybe the sensors? What can the sensors not do strictly? That's right, so they can't actually detect color, and we get around that by having this idea of a color filter array that's on in front of the sensors. And this color filter array means that we have to recombine all of these individual colors to create one pixel. And what was the result of that? This algorithm. So we had some artifacts that happened, but overall, what's the problem with using an algorithm like this rather than having all of the colors fall onto each individual pixel? Aberrations, but more general than that. The main difference between the Fovean sensor, which had the individual color channels in one pixel, and the Bayer filter array, for example, there's one big difference. Sorry?
Well, losing some of the information.
That's right, losing the information, so it was much softer. So the fovean sensor was actually a much sharper picture than the Bayer filter array. And so this image here may not be the best image to show this, because it is actually a very long exposure. And so since it was in a moving car, we do expect to see some motion blur slightly as well. But we'll use this image because I want to demonstrate a technique where we can try to battle this problem with color filter arrays, the softness that we get because of recombining the colors, and we want to actually sharpen this image. And so you can actually just use a filter and a sharpened filter like Sharpen or Sharpen More or Smart Sharpen, or Sharpen, a variety of the ones here. But the one that is very popular among photographers is this unsharp mask. And this unsharp mask, you don't want to overdo it, because remember when we were talking in artifacts last week, we mentioned one particular artifact in particular with regards to sharpening. You remember what that one was? Remember we had a quarter circle that was gray, and then we sharpened that circle. It was an aliased circle, so it had a soft edge. And what did we do when we sharpened it? We hardened the edge, but we went too far. And so we had this... That's right, we had the halo effect, where the inside of the circle was the color black, and then the outside was the color white, which when zoomed out, it looks very obnoxious. It doesn't look right. And so if by using normal sharpening techniques you get halos, we can actually use this unsharp mask, because it's a slightly smarter version of a sharpening method. And you'll notice that we have three options here: an amount, a radius, and a threshold. And what we are doing is we are controlling then the actual algorithm that happens when we are performing an unsharp mask on this image. And so what actually happens to this? Well, if we can do this manually. We can do an unsharp mask manually. And don't get confused, just because it's called unsharp, it's actually a sharpening tool. So even though it sounds like it's the opposite, it actually is indeed sharpening for you. And the reason that this confusion may have come about is that the way this tool works is that it first blurs the image. So let's just try this as a quick example. So I'm going to just duplicate this layer so that I just now have two layers of the same one, and I'm going to blur it much in the same way that this unsharp mask would blur it. So I'll just use a blur and a Gaussian blur, and just do a very small amount, maybe, 0.5. No, that's not noticeable enough. I'll do 1 pixel. Okay, so if I zoom in a little bit more, you can see that it looks blurry. So this is before, hopefully you can see it on the projector as well. This is my blurred version, and this is my unblurred version. Okay, so blurred. Look particularly up here where you'll see some, this is blurred out right now, but there's some texture when I uncheck it. When I show the bottom layer, you can now see some texture again here, particularly in the top part of this image. Okay, so now that we've blurred this a little bit, we can actually subtract out this particular layer from the one underneath it. So let's say that we do a difference here. And it's very difficult to see, so let me try inverting it. Okay, so... what it looks like when we perform a difference is this, and I apologize, the contrast is very poor on this, but looking at it on a screen, you can see a very faint outline of everything that exists in the image. Whoops.
Try to turn off the
lights. Okay, yeah, I'll try turning off the lights just for a second to see. But I inverted the color so you can see it a little bit better. But here, I don't know if you can see, there's three lines right here that sort of run along the top or the roof of the image or the roof of the car. It's probably a little bit too faint. But after we perform this subtraction, we have now found some of the edges of objects within this image. And by doing that, we can then use this difference as a mask. And we can apply this adjustment layer here and actually increase the contrast. So we have a brightness, we can increase the contrast a little bit, and we use this difference as the mask for that. And so all we are doing is we are saying that the locations that we have actually found edges through this method of blurring it slightly. So if we just go a couple steps back, just as a quick review. So we blurred it slightly, and then we are taking the difference between this blurred version and this unblurred version. That then helps us find the edges. And then we can use that resulting difference and use that as a mask for a contrast layer, and we can then selectively sharpen certain aspects of the image. So we're not sharpening some things like this very fine texture up here, because if you sharpen some details that are very, very fine, you'll very quickly get these halos that you can get as a result of normal sharpening tools that just find contrast edges and increase the contrast between the two of them. But now we can find edges that are of much larger areas, so edges that we actually would consider to be edges rather than, let's say, the actual noise in this image itself or the actual pattern, or maybe if you have a portrait of someone, the features or the texture of the skin on their face, for example, we could find the actual edges of an object and increase the contrast of those edges only. And so I describe all of this to you so that you have an idea of how it's working. You don't actually have to do all of this manually, because the unsharp mask filter, which of course is under filter, sharpen, unsharp mask, does all of it for you. And all of these things, so the amount, the radius, and the threshold, mean different things in terms of what we had just described. And so if you remember, when I did the blur before, it asked me for an amount, how much I actually wanted to blur the image. That's the radius here. So if you have a very, very large radius, for example, then you will affect the size of the edges of the thing that you wish to enhance. And the amount, so the amount is the top one there, and that's so it's always listed as a percentage, and it tells this sharpening mask layer how much to increase the contrast. So you might want to start out with something like, rather than 50%, maybe 150, maybe 200%, maybe 100, something like that. The radius you generally want to be pretty small. You generally will probably start at around 0.5 pixels or so. Because if it's too large, then you won't be able to actually increase the contrast of edges within the frame itself. So then the threshold. So remember that I mentioned what we did was we subtracted the blurred copy from the original copy. The threshold is what we decide after actually performing that difference. We are deciding what we are going to sharpen based on that difference. So if there is something that's a very, very small difference, then we shouldn't consider that to be an edge, right? So the colors might be very, very similar. We don't want to consider that an edge, and so we would want to have a relatively low threshold so that we are sure that we are not subtracting out, or rather, we want to have a relatively low threshold so that we are sure that we are only touching the edges of actual objects and not, let's say, pixels, little pixelation noise, random noise, or texture, very fine texture within the image itself. And so you typically want to also have the threshold be fairly low for images, maybe 2 levels, maybe 3 levels, something like that. Okay, so I've typed in some starting point numbers here, and every image is going to be different. If you're taking an image of something with a lot of fine detail, you're obviously going to need to have different values than if you have something that doesn't have a lot of fine detail, but maybe has a very large object that doesn't have very much detail on it. So maybe like some stainless steel, for example, which is a very large object. Typically, you have to find the edges of that block rather than, let's say, cloth, where you will have very fine detail. And so you just put some starting values here and modify them until you get what you want. And so let's see, we can try to show you the before and after photo. So this is before. This is the amount of blur that's happened with the original photo. This isn't the blurred copy. This is the original photo that I actually took, and there's no masking, no anything going on. It's just the original one. So now if I click preview, you'll see the result of this unsharp mask. And you can see that it has actually sharpened some of the details within the image. So I'll go back to the blurred version or the original version. And now some of the details are back. And so, like I said, this perhaps isn't the best image, but since it was here, I wanted to use it. But you will really notice a difference in, say, portraits. So let's see, I probably have a good portrait image that I can show you. I just need to find it. And by modifying this, you can really sharpen your images. And this is a great thing to do in addition to increasing the contrast and increasing the saturation. What people really love to see are sharp, contrasty, colorful images. And by increasing the saturation and the contrast, and by increasing the, or by applying an unsharp mask filter, you can then do a really good job of making your photos pop. Okay, so here I have a photo of some figurines. And so you see this is sort of a difficult shot because there's a lot of noise in this image, and so I don't want to make the noise more apparent. But you can see also that it's just, even though this is the focus area, it's still just a little bit blurry. It's not as sharp as I would like, and that's because of this low-pass filter that's in front of the sensor that has to be there because of this demosaicing algorithm. This goes back through all of the things that we've talked about up until now. So I want to apply an unsharp mask filter, sharpen unsharp mask, and I'll do those same values that I mentioned before just to start out. Let's see, did I say 3 or 2 before for the threshold? 2? Okay, I'll do 2. All right, so this is before. You pay particular attention to this figurine here, particularly in the eye. I think that's where I noticed on the screen the most amount of sharpening. And now this is sharpened. So if this isn't enough, then maybe I want to actually increase the amount a little bit and see if that helps. Or maybe, maybe try increasing the radius just slightly so that I don't get so much noise within it. Because as you increase the size of the radius, you're going to sharpen the edges of larger detail. So if you decrease the radius too much, then you'll start to begin sharpening the noise that exists within the image itself. So if you're sharpening too much noise, maybe you should try increasing the radius. But also this image, though, does have a lot of fine detail, because as you know, I'm zoomed in at 100%, and I have a lot of fine detail just in this small portion of the image, just because there's a lot of very small figurines. But this looks pretty good to me, a radius of 0.7, threshold of, I'm going to go up to 3, just because I like to be different like that. So this is before, so pay particular attention to this area of the image again. And after I apply my filter, it looks a lot better. And it would look even better if this image didn't have so much noise in it, but it's part of the charm of this image, arguably. And so now, of course, you won't really see it if you zoom out too much, but if you are working with an image where you have, for example, a portrait image where there's not super fine detail, but it's maybe of a person's face, then applying an unsharp mask, you will really notice a difference, even if it is somewhat zoomed out. Yes? If I use too large, what do you mean?
What happens if you try to do this?
Oh, you want to see?
Like a 50 radius.
You want to see what the wrong version looks like? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That is a good idea. I will do that. So here I have again zoomed into the same portion that we had before. These were the values that I just used: 200, 0.7 pixels, and a threshold of 3. So let's try increasing the radius to something like 7.5. Now you can see visible halos that are occurring, particularly here, for example, around these very sharp edges. We're just getting way too much halo in these fine details. As I decrease the radius, then you can see that they just don't become apparent. But now it's too much sharpening. If I increase the radius too much, then essentially everything becomes an edge and it just tries to increase the contrast of everything. So if I make the radius essentially the same, I mean, if I make the radius too large, it's as if I've just applied a higher contrast to everything, but that's too much. So you want a small radius to make sure you don't get the halos and that you don't just over contrast everything. So, okay, we'll go back to a 0.7 radius. How about threshold? What happens if you increase the threshold too much? Well, you can see that we're essentially, as we increase the threshold, the threshold is too high. There's not enough difference between the blurred version and the sharp, the original version. So it can't find any edges. So you're essentially throwing away all of your hard work. You're saying that the threshold is too high, so it can't meet your standards. It's not going to apply a radius. And if you have the amount to be too low, for example, the same thing. It's just not sharpening enough, and you're not going to see the actual sharpening effect from the unsharp mask. Now you might say, well, why then do they give us all of this extra space, all of this extra allowance here? You have to remember that we as photographers are not the only ones that use Photoshop. There's a number of designs that maybe, for example, text that's thousands of pixels large, for example, might benefit from having a very large radius, whereas we as digital photographers deal with things on the pixel level where we need a much smaller radius to actually impact the image itself. So that's why it's just not sort of friendly for us, but now that you have a starting point for these values, you should be able to get the most out of this particular thing. Any questions about unsharp mask? Great, okay. So along these lines, I wanted to just talk a little bit about resizing images. Now, if you resize an image and you make it smaller, obviously you are losing detail. But what can happen, or what some people like to do, is to actually apply an unsharp mask after you've resized an image. And in fact, this is a good point. When you are modifying an image, you should make all of your modifications first. So do all the masking you want, change all of the saturation contrast settings that you want first, and do unsharp mask last. It should be the last thing you do before you save it as a JPEG and export it to your website or send it to your friends. Because if you're increasing the contrast in a very small section and it's just you're going to be throwing away data, it's just not going to work out very well. It should be the last thing you do. But one of the things that you can do to really try to make your resized images look better, if you're not doing some sort of a clean resize, so for example, 25% is pretty clean because if you're making 4 pixels in a square, you're just resizing it down to 1, and that's pretty easy of an algorithm to figure out. Same thing with 50% or any of these percents that are relatively even. But as soon as you get to kind of strange percentages, so right now I have, for example, 16.67, but what if I went to something like 6.34%, and you can see that, well, that's too small. Let me do something crazier, like 39.6. Now, you will be able to notice that it just doesn't look as sharp or as well done as it should. And what's happening is that it has to try to figure out how to fit all of the pixels into a smaller amount. And so what some people like to do is to actually blur their images slightly. So let's go back to 100%. So we can actually apply a very, very small amount of blur. So using that Gaussian blur, not 1 pixel, that's way too much. Maybe something like 0.2 pixels or something like that, just to very gently soften the image. Then when you resize it, then what you've done is you've already started to make some of the neighboring pixels closer to each other or closer to each other in terms of their values, right? So that's what you're doing by blurring it. And so then you can imagine, I have to do some hand waving here, but you can imagine that it's then easier for the algorithm to be able to match pixels that are relatively close to each other down into a smaller size. And so once we've resized our image, and remember you should, unless you really know what you're doing, you should always change the constrain the proportions so that the width changes the same amount as the height. So now let's say that I want to actually change it to 39.4%. Now that I've blurred it, now I can try to unblur some of those details by using an unsharp mask and trying to get a little bit extra pop out of my resized image. So even if you don't decide to blur your image, which could be a little bit dangerous, you could overdo the blur and then not be able to regain some of that sharpness after you've resized the image. So you could just resize the image and just as a tip, use the unsharp mask and just sharpen just ever so slightly. Just do a little bit of sharpening and you'll really help get your pictures to pop a little bit more. And so you can see now, even by using the same values, even it looks quite a bit better. There's some halo effect going on, particularly in the eyebrows of this figurine here. But it does look, with some tweaking, it would look quite a bit better. It would just look more pleasing to the eye. Okay. Any questions about that? Yes?
There's also a setting which is bicubic sharper, so you can shrink the image by applying a bicubic sharper, and that's one that actually sharpens the image as it
Right. So Photoshop does have a variety of resizing methods. For bicubic, for example, bicubic sharper, bicubic smoother. You can also use one of these other bicubic options. I really don't recommend nearest neighbor if you're using photographs at all. Ignore that one. It's too basic. It's too naive of an algorithm to be useful. Bilinear is also relatively naive. Bicubic is definitely the way to go. If you want to use the sharper, then you certainly can. My response to that would be that you would have more control over the sharpening that's applied after the resize. So if you find that bicubic sharper is good enough for your needs, then by all means, certainly use it. But the unsharp mask might give you a little bit more control. But that's a good thing to bring up. Thank you. Okay. Sharpening, resizing, all of this stuff. Any other questions? Now, you'll notice that one of the things about some of these images is the noise. And so as we as digital photographers enjoy relatively low noise from our digital SLRs, or even our compact cameras do a fairly good job with noise, especially compared to some of the high ISO films that used to be around. Even ISO 400 film, you could really notice the film grain in it. And so arguments of the aesthetics of the film grain aside, sometimes you really want to try to minimize the amount of noise that exists within your image. And so we've talked about all of the obvious ways of decreasing noise, like using a lower ISO if you can, increasing the brightness of the scene so that you can use a lower ISO while keeping a fast enough shutter speed. But you can also try to decrease the noise in software, in Photoshop. And unfortunately, I don't have any good photos for this example. But let's just imagine for a minute that I had this image on, or I had the camera when I was taking this image on a tripod, and I took a variety of photos at the same exposure settings for maybe, I don't know, 3-4 times. So all of the exposures are properly exposed, which means that they all would look like this, but I have 3 or 4 images that look exactly the same, except for one small thing. Noise, for the most part, we can consider it to be random. Now, there's some cameras that don't have random noise that you would notice as they sometimes call it banding, sometimes in shadow regions. Particularly, the 20D is susceptible to this. I know because I notice it and it's annoying. Not sure you can see it. It's not really dark enough in this image, but in shadow regions, you'll notice that there's bands of noise where it looks sort of, if you take a look at a block of an image. So let's say we have a shadow here. We're going to blow it up so that we can actually take a closer look at it. Now, what happens is that you see noise that looks sort of like this, where it just sort of fades away, and then it's strong, and then it fades away like that. That's what I mean by banding, where you have concentrated portions of noise in a pattern-like fashion. And so it may or may not be actual horizontal bands. It could be vertical bands, a variety of things. This technique won't help with that because that's systematic. It's systemic to the camera itself, and you won't be able to do it. But if we have truly random noise, like we can generally assume for high ISO images from quality cameras, then what you can do is average all of these images together and decrease the noise a bit. So how does this work? Well, I will demonstrate on this, even though it won't be perfect. So let's say that I have two images. Tap your fingers. Okay, so I have here two images, A and B. I'm going to close this masking one because we don't need it for now. We have this image here and this image here, and they are both exactly the same. And what I'll do is maybe I'll just add a little bit of noise to each of them just to show you how we can try to reduce it. So what I'm doing here is I am pretending that I've taken two different photos and that each photo then has different amounts of random noise, or perhaps the same amount of noise, but they're randomly distributed, so the noise is slightly different in each. So I'll add, the selected area is empty. Okay. I have the wrong thing selected here, so let me just add a little bit of noise. All right, so this might make it pretty obvious. Can you see the noise that exists here, the amount of noise that I'm adding? So I'll add that much to this image, and I will add the same amount, and it's not going to add the exact same noise. Hopefully it's at least pseudo-random. Uniform, all right, let's do, uniform sounds good. Uniform random noise. Okay, so now we can see that I'll zoom in on each. I have noise on each of these images. Now again, I'm just simulating if you had taken two separate photos at a very high ISO. And in fact, this is probably what some of your photos from compact digital cameras would look like, just very noisy, sort of obnoxiously so. It's a little bit too much. Now what I can do is I can select an entire image. So what I'm doing here is I've selected the whole thing. You can go to select, select all, and then I'm copying the image, and I'm going to paste it on top as a new layer on top of this other one. Okay, so I have a mismatch in color profiles because I opened this one in sRGB. It had sRGB tagged to it, and when I when I created this new one, I probably accidentally created it in the Adobe RGB profile. So what I'll do is I'll paste it, and it's going to convert for me. That's a problem, but it's no relevance to what we are trying to achieve here. Okay, so now you see that I have two layers here. Now it's the two separate photos with the different noise levels in each. So what I can do to actually reduce the noise, like I said, is to average these. And the way that I do that is that I change the opacity of the top layers. So you'll notice here that I have an opacity level of 100%, which means that the top layer is fully showing. It's 100% there. And what I am seeing from this image, this composite image, it's 100% of this image that I pasted in from it. But what I want to do is actually average the two, which means that I should make the opacity 50%. So that way 50% of this image shines through, then 50% of the bottom image shines through. So I'll change the opacity to 50. Well, here, let me first zoom in so you can see the obnoxious noise that we have in this image. And then what I will do is I will average the two by changing the opacity to 50%. Okay. And now what that should have done, assuming that the noise was random, which it may not be, was change the noise. Okay, this makes me sad because it's not actually, it doesn't appear to be truly random. But what it does is it changes the amount of noise. It decreases the amount of noise because you are adding, you're adding extra signal, but you are decreasing the signal to noise ratio, you are increasing the signal to noise ratio because you are increasing the amount of signal. You have extra images here, so you have more signal, and you have the same amount of noise, but assuming that the noise is random and distributed randomly, then what you get is an averaging of that and a reduction, or I'm sorry, an increase in the signal-to-noise ratio. I think I saw a question somewhere. No? Okay. So maybe what I should actually do is try to, let's see. I'm going to try this one more time, but with that other blur amounts, and see if I can get it to I will see if I can get it to work as we expect. This hopefully this live demo isn't going to go completely bust on me just because I am doing it this way. Okay, so I'm using a Gaussian distribution, which now just means that the noise is going to be slightly different. Copying it again. I'll delete this old layer, paste it right on top, or I still have that color problem. And now I will try to, okay, there. Now it was much more apparent. So let me zoom in and I will show you again. So I had originally an image that looked like this, which is noisy and obnoxious. But what I'm doing by averaging the two, by changing the opacity to 50%, you can now see that it's averaging the noise. It's averaging the signal. It's reducing the noise for me, and I can see the images much better. So this is handy not only for this case where we have a very high ISO image, but even for relatively low ISO images. If you notice that you have some noise, for example, some Nikon digital SLRs, for example, can only have the lowest ISO of 200. A low ISO rating of 200. And if you want a better ISO rating, you can simulate that by taking two properly exposed photos. They have to be exactly the same and averaging the two. And then you can effectively decrease the noise by that much. You can actually take additional photos as well. So if you really wanted to go nuts, you could add third exposure, fourth exposure, so on and so forth. But you have to be sure to adjust the opacity by that much as well. So what I mean by that is, let's say we had another layer on top of this. The layer on top of this layer one would have to be, it would have to have an opacity of 25%, because the bottom two are, no, I'm sorry, 33%, because the bottom two layers would represent 66% of the image. The top one would represent a third, so you have to change the opacity to 33%. If you had a fourth layer, you have to make the fourth layer opacity to be 25%, and so on and so forth.
Could you do the before and after again?
The before and after, sure. Be happy to show off my awesome live demo skills. So here we have the before. No, this is the after. Here we have the before image, which is very, very noisy. And just by changing the opacity to 50%, I'm essentially averaging the result of the two, and I'm decreasing the noise level on it. Yes?
Would you mind turning off the eyeball for the layer one and then turning it back on so we can see the difference between the back, you know, the original noise?
So you want me to, oh, I see. So you want me to,
no, the other one.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is, all right, so because of the way that the noise is distributed, it appears as though the noise in so you'll notice that one thing is clear. It looks like the noise is shifting slightly. That's because we're averaging it, but it is actually increasing the signal to noise ratio. We are actually getting a better amount of signal in this image and reducing the amount of noise. Any other questions? Okay. All right, let's take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll talk about high dynamic range images. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So now we are finally going to talk about the thing that we have been slowly building up for a long time, high dynamic range images. And so high dynamic range images are actually not a new concept to photography. There is a photographer known as Gustave Legray. Back in the early days of photography, in the mid-19th century, actually. And he realized that, film back then, first of all, was terrible compared to even the film that we have now, which, of course, is a lot better. But the dynamic range of the film back then was quite low. And that gives rise to a lot of these sort of photos that we see now where the contrast appears to be very, very high. It's just it's not capable of capturing very much dynamic range. And it got to the point where he couldn't take a photo like this, of this sort of scene, of the sea with the sky, without the sky, without one of two things happening. Either the sky was completely white from being completely overexposed, or the sea was completely dark because it was then completely underexposed. And so he had this idea of merging two different exposures together to get a resulting image that had a higher dynamic range than was possible with the technology that he had at the time. And in fact, this is relatively simple, and it was pretty easy for him because there's a very well-defined horizon, and so there wasn't a lot of cutting of film or dual exposing of film to happen, or that needed to happen. And so what he would actually do is he actually used... I don't have flash on this. That's embarrassing. So he would actually use this method, and he used, I think, the same sky or the same sea image. Now I can't plug this in. This is getting worse. In order to show... One second while this comes up. So he would use the same image for a couple of occasions. And where is my mouse? We are just going downhill today, I gotta say. Oh, I think my computer froze. Okay. We're out of luck. So you'll have to see this from home. I'll link to it on the webpage. But there's... I don't know why they would use flash. It basically shows two images side by side where he'd done this in two separate occasions. You can really tell where he had cut the middle of the photograph out, so that he had, I believe, two different sea scenes, but with the same sky, and it's not really apparent until you put the two images side by side that he actually did this. But this was one of the first examples of a high dynamic range image. And the idea, again, is to just take multiple exposures. If the scene itself has a dynamic range that is larger than that of your digital camera or of your film camera, and recombining the exposures at a later date to actually allow the full amount of dynamic range that was present in the scene to be present in your final image. And so high dynamic range images have gotten to the point where people have gotten really creative with them and done some really ridiculous things, such as this image, which looks very cartoonish, but it actually is a high dynamic range image. It is just, it has so many exposures involved, and it has a tone curve that is such that it really flattens all of the colors and makes it look very cartoony. But you can tell, especially in the sky up here, that it is actually a photograph. It's just a very high dynamic range image that was made of a composite of multiple images. And we can simulate a sort of high dynamic range image, although it's not strictly the case that it is, by using a mask that simulates a graduated neutral density filter. And if you remember, a graduated neutral density filter is darker on one half and lighter on the other half, so that you could, let's say you had a very bright sky, you could selectively darken the sky while allowing the lower portion of the image to have a relative brightness that is then brighter. And you can do that in Photoshop just by adding a mask, an adjustment layer that increases the brightness, and then you just make a gradient. I believe I showed this in the last Photoshop class where we were talking about masking. But high dynamic range is a little bit different. It's for cases where we have an image that is a bit more complex. Maybe it's not a very simple horizon, or where we can just use a tool like that. Or maybe the change in brightness levels is so extreme that using just one exposure and masking it would be enough. And so, for example, what I did, because I realized that unfortunately I don't have any really good examples of this, is before class I took this photo. And this is a terrible photo, But it's terrible because the dynamic range of the scene is obviously way, way wrong for the dynamic range of the camera. Only certain aspects of this image are actually properly exposed. So, I mean, you can see details in it, but you obviously can't see details behind the chairs. You lose details in the projection. Like, you all recognize this photo. You should see a sun right here. We've lost all of these details. So what I did was I just took many photos from this place, from this placement of the camera, and just changed the exposure value on all of them. So let's see if this is going to be too slow. But you can see that essentially I started making it darker and darker and darker so that I could begin to properly expose the projection and therefore have a number of images who in total represent all of the values that exist within this scene. And so I think the last one I did, actually I had to make brighter because I realized I didn't have my histogram on, and so I then couldn't tell that in the very dark room that this first image that I took, which I showed you, this one right here, was then also too dark. It's just not well enough exposed. So I had to go back and actually then, where is it? Uh-oh, I'm not sure I transferred it from the camera. But there is an additional, oh, I didn't, that's stupid. There is an additional image that is considerably brighter that then shows all of the detail in the seat back would allow us to see everything within it. So I will export this while we begin working on some of these. Let me just make sure I get the right ones. Okay. And this one here. Okay, so you'll notice that what I did was I just took all of these photos, I took them in the raw format, and I didn't do any processing to them. I just exported them as 16-bit TIFFs. So just to make sure that I have as much data as I possibly can from every single exposure. And then after I had all of those TIFFs, what I'm going to do now is import them into Photoshop to create my high dynamic range photo. What I'm going to do first is export the remaining photos so that I am sure that we have everything that we want to work with. So there is a very nice tool within the newer versions of Photoshop, CS2, CS3, and up, that actually allow for, that there's a nice tool that's available in all of these that make this process much simpler than it used to be. And so if we go to the file menu and automate, there is a merge to HDR option here that we can select. And what we do is we select a number of files. You obviously have to have two or more files in order to create a high dynamic range image. And we select all of these and we create an image that is essentially a high dynamic range image. However, there is something that is slightly unusual about the image that we create, and that is, I will just add a couple of TIFFs to show you what happens. Click OK, and it's going to take a little bit of time. It does some process, it automates some process for us. And in a second, so you'll notice that this is going to take a while when we actually compile all of our images together, we get this merged result. And so already it looks a bit better than it did before individually, just with two exposures. But what's unique about this is take a look at the bit depth underneath the OK and cancel button in the upper right-hand corner. It says that it is a bit depth of 32 bits. Now, up to this point, we've only been talking about images that are 8 bits or 16 bits, but now we have a 32-bit image. And this, keep in mind, this doesn't mean that we have twice as many bits, right? We have how many more bits here? It's almost... Yeah, it's doubled for every one. So we have 2 to the 16 times more bits to deal with. Well, we have to multiply that times. So it's big. We have a lot more bits to work with. And so the reason for this is that Photoshop and a variety of other high dynamic range tools that are out there actually compiles all of these images, and it analyzes the data within it, not only the values that represent the pixels, but also the EXIF data, so that it knows what exposure each photograph was taken at. And then it tries to figure out from that information what the raw brightness value should be at every pixel for every image. And then it applies linearly, in a linear format, in this 32-bit file, all of this brightness that exists within the file. And that's why it's 32 bits. It's so that, remember when we were talking about sensor linearity, that every time we double the value, that means a double in brightness. So if we are working with 16 bits or 8 bits, it's not enough to represent all of the values from a high dynamic range scene to fit within one of these files. So we have to use a very high bit file, a 32-bit file, to store this linear data before we can apply a tone curve to it. And so right now, Photoshop has actually applied a specific tone curve to it so that we can actually see an initial result of this high dynamic range image. And if you're very serious about high dynamic range images, Photoshop is great, but there are specific tools that have a lot more options, a lot greater control over the tonal range or over the tone curve that is applied to the high dynamic range image, and you can get the result like this image that I showed you before of this very cartoon style high dynamic range image. It's not to say that you couldn't do this in Photoshop, but there are tools out there that exist that would perhaps make this easier. Now, when you make a high dynamic range image, there's a certain set of requirements that you have to fulfill in order to do it. So your very darkest exposure, the one where everything is going to be black, you have to make sure that you capture in that all of the details from the highlights. So in other words, as these photos got darker and darker and darker, I was sure that the darkest one actually had all of the detail from the slide or from the projector that I wanted it to have. Let's see, is that here? And in fact, I even went a little bit beyond so that I was sure that I have all of the color values that are represented. And so here you can see that now this is too dark, but that's okay. I'll still input this in Photoshop by doing this calculation based on the EXIF data. So what is the actual shutter speed? What is the ISO? What is the aperture? It can then figure out the values of each of these. And the more data I give Photoshop, the more accurate it's going to be. So you have then this photo, that's the darkest, and you have all of the data in the highlights in this dark photo. And then you should go maybe one step, no more than two stops up and increase the exposure so it becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. So all of these are a difference of one stop until you get all of the detail from the shadows. And so this one, I forgot, like I said, to transfer all of the ones. So this one's a poor example, but I have other ones where it's very, very bright. And the projector is then completely overexposed, but I see all of the data that exists within the shadow regions here. So if you don't actually if you don't actually take all of the photos that exist within that exposure space, you are going to miss out on a lot of the data. You're actually sort of destroying the point of a high dynamic range image if you don't have all of the exposures captured. 15 seconds. I don't know if I can talk for that long. Yes. What happens if you add an external light source to some of them? So in general, you don't want any changes, whether it be movement or lighting changes, from one to the next, because you could... So I didn't... Well, I might have some that are slightly off, but you would have a resulting dynamic range image that has different values within it, and so it may not be what you expect. So you might get some weird artifacts out of it, is what I'm trying to say. How it would actually appear, it's difficult to describe. It's what actually changes. So, for example, if you can't take a very good high dynamic range photo of the sea, for example. Because with the sea, what happens is you have the waves that are coming in, and every time you take an exposure, the waves are actually different. And so you would then be adding all of these values together where the waves appear in different places, and so you would get, maybe that's a surreal effect that you actually want to achieve, but that's probably not what we want when we're talking about a strict high dynamic range shot. Okay, so I have here then a much brighter image, you can see, that includes a lot of the data that I missed out on before. I've completely overexposed it, but it looks okay. So one more thing that I want to mention that I'll talk about while it's processing this, you'll notice that we have a histogram up here, excuse me, which shows us a range of stops based on some red ticks, and also there's a slider here that picks what's called the white point. And so Photoshop has picked a white point for us, and it's that point that becomes white in the resulting image. And if we increase the slider, then we are saying that some actual brighter component should be the white point, but then we essentially make it appear to be darker. And we can also make it darker, but then now we're sort of going the wrong way. Okay, so let me then add all of these photos that I can. I will automate, merge to HDR, and find my files. Let's see, I think I want 387 to 399. Let me just take a look on my computer here to make sure that is what I want. Okay, so there's actually some images here that have slight changes in them, and so it will be interesting to see what happens, and I'll show you these in a second. Okay, so this attempt to automatically align source images, I'm going to uncheck it for now because that requires a bit of extra processing time. If you have a very sturdy tripod and you're sure that they're actually all perfectly centered, that they haven't actually moved, then you don't need to do that as it adds more processing time. And this computer isn't the fastest one around, so I'm just going to uncheck it for now and we'll just deal with the result. Yes?
Can you expose on camera raw multiple images, different exposures, and use them to make a high dynamic range?
Use different cameras with different exposures? Or?
No, one exposure, but to expose on camera raw.
Oh, I see. So you've taken a raw photo and you've then processed it at different exposure levels. Yes and no. If you're going to do it that way, then I think using this method is probably overkill, because what you are doing is taking the raw linear data from the raw file, applying a tone curve to it, and then importing it back into Photoshop and asking Photoshop to refigure out what the raw brightness values were at each pixel, and then you're just going to apply a different tone curve to that. So what's probably better in that case is to use masking techniques or to apply a different tone curve, because in that case you are just working with the same brightness values that exist, and only once you have two unique exposures, then can you get, can you use something like this? Okay, so obviously at some point I really messed something up here. Let's see, what image is this? So you can see that now the result of me actually having changed something where I must have lowered the camera. I don't remember doing this for some reason, but now you can see that there's sort of shadows of what existed before. So you can see the outline of a chair here, but you can also see the backs of these two chairs in front of it kind of going down into it. So I've added one too many photos, I think, and I will have to go back and figure out which ones I actually want to use. So let's see.
Can you just uncheck them?
Yes, I can, but I'm still... need to figure out which ones it is. So it looks like it's these last two. Okay, so now I've gotten rid of those. And so you can see something else as well, where I have, is that one even? Okay, that was a bad one as well. So you can see here, there's a problem where the tripod moved at some point. You can see the faint outline. If you look at the tripod legs here of Chris's video camera, you can see that they don't align properly. So there is some problem with this, and unfortunately it looks like, despite how careful I was when I moved the camera and went back to the original place, I actually moved it ever so slightly and moved it enough that this became a problem. So now this looks like we are going to be using Photoshop's very fancy automatically aligned source images. And hopefully I'll have something to talk about while it does this for a couple of minutes. Okay, so now while it's doing this, realize that although this is a decent example, there are perhaps more relevant scenes where an HDR image could apply. So remember that I was able to compress the dynamic range of the scene, as I showed you in that one image, just by turning on the lights. But there's many other cases where you actually are in perhaps a location where you can't modify the lights. So maybe you are, for example, taking a photograph of a cityscape where you have many buildings in the image, and you notice that the dynamic range is far too high, which can happen frequently with night shots, for example. When you're taking a night shot scene, you get very bright point sources of light from the street lights, and you have pretty much everything else is way too dark. And so what you would want to do then is selectively increase the exposure for a variety of things through a variety of settings until you can properly expose everything, and then later on recombine it. And so you can actually get some very impressive night shot HDR or high dynamic range images just by using this sort of method. And one of the great things about it is that you then retrieve a lot of the color that may be lost in the darkness of the shadow. So let's see, I have here, while this is doing its thing, I can probably show you one more example of a high dynamic range image. Oh, this is such a long URL for me to type. WP content uploads 2008-07 Bangkok night small. Why does it say small and medium in the URL? That's a silly thing, I think. Okay, so here now, this is a high dynamic range shot of what must be Bangkok, but you can see that now we've gotten a lot of color out of this shot without overexposing. Well, I mean, we have overexposed a lot of the point sources, but without exposing them so much that they bloom and that we lose the detail in the buildings. So this is a fairly conservative high dynamic range shot. It's not done so distastefully or so artistically, however you want to look at it, that we then get a sort of surreal look out of it. But it's instead done just to show you all of the detail and the color that exists within the city nightscape. And now this is when I cross my fingers, as I have completely run out of things to say, that this has completed, and we're going to get the hourglass. Oh boy, this is awkward. So, what do you guys want to talk about? How was your weekend?
In the film world, one company once made high dynamic range film. It was EG&G, the engineering folks, who did a lot of work for the Atomic Energy Agency. And they took Kodak color film, which normally has three layers, one for each color, and they changed it so it was sensitive. So they were all black and white standard sensitive films. And one was ASA 400, one was ASA 25, one was ASA 0.002.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And you could just take a picture of anything from, you know, a desert scene to a mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was at least one of the layers would capture something, and you could combine the layers.
That's really neat. So that they could then layer all of these different... So there's... If you remember, we had there was that sensor from Fujifilm, I believe, that tries to do something similar, where they had a larger sensor well and then a much smaller sensor well, the smaller one being much less sensitive, so that they could then increase the dynamic range, especially up in the highlights, so that they could then retrieve a lot of the highlight data from in overexposed shots and apply a different tone curve that allows you to get a lot of detail up in the highlights that would be lost normally. So that could help with blooming and a variety of things. But that's really interesting that they did that in film as well. They used layers.
Color print film processing. And it helps colors in it because in the processing, each of the layers, you know, gets turned into a color.
Well, so it didn't even need special processing either. So we've definitely gone.
They have used special, there's panchromatic black and white paper they have used to capture the black and white image from all the color layers.
But the developing sounds like it's the same development, standard development. So we've certainly gone a step back where I have to stand up here awkwardly twiddling my thumbs as crops are performed on each of these images and where this film existed where we could actually use high dynamic range photos just by having this film with different layers. So just to repeat for the camera, it sounds like there was this film that existed with different layers where each layer was black and white, but it still had different levels of sensitivity from, it sounded like 400 to 50, ISO 50.
425 and 0.002.
425 and 0.002. So that's really, that's quite a large.
Atomic Energy Commission doing things that we really don't want
to
know about.
Yeah, I would love to see some photos that resulted from that. I think that would be really neat to see. What kind of very large, high dynamic range shots they have. Oh man, that's annoying. Okay, so this is done. Hopefully I can just uncheck the offending images. Oh man, this is really, that's really annoying. So, all right, so it's not perfect. Oh, now it's perfect. Okay, so now we have a better high dynamic, oh thank you, although this is now too dark as well, but we can hopefully apply a better tone curve to help get send the detail out. Yes.
I guess what I don't understand is that the screen there is still completely overexposed, and all that detail that you were trying to capture in those darker images still isn't showing up.
Right. So this is before we've actually applied a tone curve to the. So Photoshop is applying just a standard tone curve to this for us, but we haven't actually yet tweaked and selected the proper tone curve that we want in order to get the detail out. And also, remember this white point, as you can see, is really far to the left. And so if we were to increase it, we can select a new white point and get some of the details out from this highlight region. And so there seems to be a slight problem still with this lateral change. It looks like there's one image in particular that's being fairly offensive to us. I wonder if it's this one here. There's a variety of them, but once we apply a better tone curve, then hopefully we should be able to get a more standard high dynamic range image out of it. So right now I will accept this white point. We're just going to have to work with what we have, and so right now I just want to set the white point and set it and say, okay, this is what we want to use for now. Yes?
Is there a minimum number of images that you need for this technique to work?
You need at least two images for this to work.
And would something like this work with pictures of trees with the sun setting behind them?
Pictures of trees with the sun setting behind them? It would if there's no wind, if the trees are not moving. If it's perfectly still, then yeah, you could probably take a successful shot. But if there's any motion at all, then I would say you would be very frustrated, just like I am right now, with this this difference in position. Even though Photoshop claims to have this magic reposition, it just doesn't seem to work all that well. Okay, so I will accept this for now, and I'll click OK. You notice that it's going to create a file, and when it creates this file, it's going to create it in a 32-bit format. And so we've worked with 8-bit. And a little bit with 16-bit, but not really with 32-bit. And one of the things that you'll notice once we start poking around with this 32-bit file is that there's not a lot of changes that we can really do. Not a lot of the filters will work with a 32-bit file, and we will have to actually convert it to a lower-bit file and therefore apply a tone curve to it before we can actually work with it. And what this 32-bit file is useful for, though, is we can actually save it so that we can come back to it later. If we apply a tone curve that we don't like and we've worked with it for a while, and we say, oh, I really want to go back and make another change somehow. That's really all this 32-bit file is useful for, at least for now. So we could save this file as a Photoshop file, and it would be a 32-bit file, but let's see, I don't even know how big would this file be. It would be pretty monstrous if it's 32 bits and 8 megapixels, which is the size of this. But now what I need to do to apply a tone curve is to actually change the mode from 32 bits per channel down to 8 or 16. So I'm going to destine this for the web, so I'll actually bring it down to 8 bits per channel, so it'll be, we can save it as a JPEG. And now you'll notice a couple of things. So we have here an HDR conversion tool that comes up where we can apply a tone curve to it. We see a histogram now of the data that we have available to us. We can try to increase or decrease the exposure. We can try to increase or decrease the gamma, which remember is the the contrast in the image. And then we have more tools here where we can try to modify the tone curve to make it look exactly as we want. So let's say, so people were saying that it's a little bit dark, so I can perhaps it's going to just deal with this here. So I can try to increase the brightness, for example. I can try to increase the gamma a little bit if I want to bring up some of the details in the dark regions. It looks like it's actually inverse. So sliding the slider to the left will actually increase the contrast, and sliding it to the right will decrease it. And let's see if there's some way that I can actually modify.
If we change the method on top.
I'm sorry? Oh, the method, yeah. Oh, yes. So there's a variety of methods up here as well. That's a very good point. I'm glad you pointed that out. Because the one that is most useful to us is not exposure and gamma, not highlight compression, but as photographers, the one that we will typically want to use is the local adaptation. The reason that we want to do this is that this most closely matches how we perceive a scene. So when we are looking at a scene, we usually look at local contrast. Or in other words, when we are looking at something, remember that our fovea is very small. We can only see in detail a very small percentage of the scene as it exists in front of us. So when we look at something, let's say the wall, for example, you're looking at a very specific point, and your eyes are adapting to the contrast for that wall. But now if I look somewhere else, like the lights, for example, that's much brighter, my eyes adjust slightly, and I can see the contrast in the light, even though the variety between the two, the dynamic range between the two might be very, very high, our eyes adapt to look at the local dynamic range, or the local contrast that exists there. And that's what this local adaptation is attempting to do. It sacrifices global contrast or global dynamic range for local contrast or for local dynamic range. And so as you can see, that's exactly what looks like it's happening. So we're sort of violating this idea that these chairs were considerably darker than the projector screen, because now there are portions of the chairs that are perhaps as bright or maybe even slightly brighter than some portions of the projector. But that's okay, because as we perceive the scene, this is perhaps how we would actually look at it. When we look at the chair in front of us, we would be able to perceive all of the values here, or all of the colors, all of the brightness here. And as we look at the projector, we actually can perceive the brightness that exists there. So the radius then defines how large this local to global contrast change exists. So we can try to decrease the radius if you want to decrease the local contrast. You can increase the radius, and you can see that it's going to change. It's changing, but you can tell a difference. Before I brought this up, I probably should have zoomed in a little bit more so we could see more of it. And of course, then we have a threshold as well, which allows us to set a threshold for this particular idea. So typically what you want to do, you might want to have, you typically want to set the radius for the actual portion of the scene that's changing the most. And so we have here not a very large portion of the scene. We have this screen here. This is the screen that is, if we were to take one exposure, this was the one that was the most heavily overexposed. So we might set a radius of, I don't know, maybe 100 pixels or so. It's relatively large, but it's not too large within this scene, maybe 80 pixels here. And then the threshold we would also set to be relatively high, so maybe 2.5 or so. So this, that might be a little too well. I mean, that actually looks okay, but we can adjust, of course, if we want to decrease or increase the threshold to do whatever looks best. And now we actually have the capability of modifying the tone curve here. So I can compress the highlights a little bit, and I can maybe stretch the mid-tone some. So if I give too much of a contrast change here, then this changes the appearance, the tone curve for the entire scene. And so I've given it perhaps too much contrast, and I'm going in sort of the wrong direction here. So I can try to flatten it out a little bit more, or even increase the shadows a bit and decrease the highlights a bit if I really wanted to decrease the contrast and really make it much flatter here. Okay, so this isn't perfect, but the tools that exist for high dynamic range images aren't really perfect either. And so Photoshop is great for this sort of thing, which is relatively simple high dynamic range images. Like I said, there are more advanced tools out there that exist that can that would give you perhaps some more options, or some options that might make things a little bit easier. But for now, this looks pretty good to me. So when I hit OK, it's going to apply that tone curve to it, convert from this 32-bit image all the way down to a fraction of the number of values to an 8-bit image, and we will see the resulting image, which will look almost exactly the same. In fact, it should be the same. It's just going to have the tone curve applied to it. So then after I've applied my tone curve, I can save it. But what I've done is gone from an image that looks like it really sucks the fun out of it when it takes so long to generate a preview. That looks like this, from having regions that are completely underexposed and regions that are completely overexposed, to one that looks like this, albeit, oh man. Oh, God. oh man, that really ruins it. All right, wait just a second, 8 bits per channel. And we have this, boom, where we can see detail in everything. And so we could do some additional tweaking. You can see, I really would like to see perhaps this image on the projector to actually look like it should. So maybe rather than, maybe increase the contrast a little bit in this projector a little bit so that the bottom part actually looks a little bit darker. And the screen up here looks a little bit brighter. And also, I would redo the photo so that I don't have this displacement within certain things. And you can see we actually have an arm here also in the image as well. And a ghost arm, because there's no elbow attached to it. But overall, we have then really changed the appearance of this image for the better, from this to this, even though we could do slightly more tweaking. Do it one more time. So we changed from this image. Let me actually open it in Photoshop and zoom in a little bit so we can be impressed with my live demo handiwork, where we have a lack of detail in the chairs and a lack of detail in the projector. And we actually changed to, where is it? This, where we have all of the detail returned. Yay, so that's high dynamic range in a very nerve-wracking live demo, I must add. So next week, we have assignment 4 and 3 slideshow. It will not be videotaped, so if you want to see it, do be sure to come by, and you can excitedly jump up and down when your fantastic image is displayed on the projector, and we will have we will also have just very brief discussion about some of the legal issues that we as photographers have run into, which we've addressed in the past. We've had some folks had a run-in with the laws, as it sounds, and of course I'm not a lawyer, but we will talk about some of the issues, and it will be a very excellent final lecture. And so with that, thank you all for coming, and I will see you next week.